Okay. Well, we joined the lecture already in progress because I forgot to turn on the recorder
for the first 30 minutes. Wait a minute.
Okay. You
get. Sorry about that. Well, the next 45. Picture and erase. Questions or comments? Just about done with this next proof. Fit it under the definition of the limit statement. Make it a little easier to follow. Okay, so for every epsilon greater than zero, we're going to do a couple things we can do here. We want to choose things like this. Choose the P partition as hypothesized by the claim. Sums at most epsilon apart, provided I have at least as many cut points in my partition as P has. I cut everywhere P cuts and then possibly some other places. So then, all Q less than P, we have the here we just have to make sure things are not too far away. But fortunately, that number I, we're going to have that number I be, we can write it either as the supremum or the infimum there. It's the same number. Let's see. So I want to have that this either the infinite or the supremum minus epsilon is less than or equal to my lower sum for Q. So how do we get the lower sum here? So we look at our definitions. The supremum of the lower sum doesn't look good. Right, that would take us higher. I think the way to go is to look at the infimums of the upper sums. So here's what we write. Infimum over all the upper sums that minus epsilon would just be less than or equal to any particular upper sum minus epsilon, such as the upper sum for partition Q. Okay, right? Because this is the greatest lower bound of all these upper sums. In particular, it's a lower bound for all the upper sums. Now U of FQ, so this upper sum minus epsilon would be less than or equal to the lower sum, right? Because we've made sure they were most epsilon apart. Just subtract epsilon from both sides of this equation. And then this is so now we've gotten to this part. Okay. If I annotated right, I want to get this, this, this. And so putting these two inequalities together gives us the first one. Okay. Now the second one just comes for free. That's true for any partition. Okay. It's because we're talking about the same partition here. So there's nothing to do there. And then here, to get the last one, we do kind of a trick symmetrical to what we did there. So this upper sum here is at most, what we know is at most this lower sum plus epsilon by hypothesis. And the lower sum is at most the any upper bound for all the lower sums. Okay. And the supremum is the least upper bound for all the lower sums. And we just carry the plus epsilon along for the ride. Okay. And so that's it. These two things here, string them together, and you've got the third requirement there. So that proves the claim.
all you need to have
an integral in the Riemann sense is really this. I mean, this follows from this weaker thing. All you need is to find some partition where the lower and the upper sums are at most epsilon apart.
So
now we can talk about maybe it's not the erasure that's the problem, it's the coordinate. Yeah, that or this eraser of mine is not that great either. This is the eraser from my office. Can't see the window. I will try a new eraser next week. If that doesn't work. Still the chalkboard. So, what we definitely want to do is prove that continuous functions are integrable. Right? And think about intuitively, here's how I think of a continuous function on a closed integral domain. I think of it as I can draw the graph without having to make some kind of jump like that. So I can just keep my chalk stick on the board without ever having to pick it up. I can draw the whole graph from one end to the other. It doesn't have to be smooth, okay? I mean, if you want, you could have something like a corner or something. As long as it still passes the vertical line test. So steep, but not vertical. It's okay there. But it can have corners and so on. But you have to be able to, intuitively speaking, you have to be able to draw the whole thing. That intuition is not strictly true because you can have a function that, on small scales, does an infinitely complex wiggling the more you zoom in. But the wiggles get smaller and smaller, so you can't see them. So it's still technically continuous, but doesn't really fit our intuition. But intuition is good enough for purposes. Right? We really expect that there should be a positive well-defined area here and a negative well-defined area here and here. Right? It really should be an area. If you actually try and prove this, turns out continuity is not enough directly. You actually need uniform continuity. Anybody remember the difference? Uniform continuity is where the delta depends only on epsilon. In regular continuity, it can depend on the epsilon and at what point you're trying to get close to. Okay. Now, fortunately, if your domain is compact, than their equivalent. That was one of the things I wrote up, because I didn't have time to talk about it in class, so it was some time ago. We're going to talk about compactness. Right. Now, every closed bounded set is compact. So let's suppose that F, and compactness also buys you some other nice facts. So merely suppose now is continuous with closed interval domain. Okay. So then now use some compactness to explain why this is actually much nicer than it looks when I just say it's continuous. So since this is a closed and bounded set, it's compact, right? That's actually equivalent when we're talking about subsets of the real line. You get by trying all the inputs in this compact set is going to be compact. Right? Continuity preserves compactness is the high-level way of saying it. Right? So the output set is also compact, but compact is equivalent to closed and bounded for sets of reals. Right? So in particular, I don't actually need the fact that it's closed, I just need that it's bounded. Okay. So that means there are some numbers A and B such that F actually does map into some finite length interval. Right, the output set is bounded, so pick a lower bound for the outputs A and an upper bound for the outputs B. So then actually F does map into that. And then as I said, on a compact set, continuity implies uniform continuity. Says for every point in the domain, I'll write it in terms of epsilon deltas. And how about I use a C since I keep using P for partitions? For every epsilon, there exists a delta, but now this delta is allowed to depend on the base point C and the epsilon. Right. Whenever the there exists comes after the for all, we're not promising that it's the same delta for each of these possible choices in epsilon. Okay? Such that for all x, there's several ways to say it. There's one way. For all x in the domain of f, if the distance from x to c is less than delta, then the distance from f of x to f of c is less than epsilon. So you can rig it so that delta closeness in inputs implies epsilon closeness in outputs. And it's the same idea with uniformly continuous, just as I said, the delta now has to work for all points. Still only has to work for one epsilon at a time. Okay. But now the same delta will have to work for every base point. We use this to our advantage with the integral. So given epsilon positive, let delta be as, let's just write it out. I'll write it out again. Okay. Such that for all x and c, now what's our domain? It's just the closed interval. Right. If inputs are delta close, the outputs are epsilon close. Now what we'll show is once we have this delta, then I can cook up a partition in which the Riemann sum is going to, the lower and upper Riemann sums are epsilon close together. Now there's one little thing here though. Think of the function output differences as a difference in height, right? We graph the outputs on the y-axis. What we actually want when with lower and upper Riemann sums, think of differences in area. So this is not quite enough. You have to divide by the width of the domain. Okay, so you can, instead of using epsilon, just you use epsilon over b minus a, so that you make the heights close enough together that when you do the lower number sums, the difference in areas will be sufficiently small. Okay, so now let's set the partition, okay? Choose n, a natural number. And you need it to be big enough that if you cut the interval really simple, let's just cut into n equal parts, that each of those pieces will be less than delta y. Okay. That's going to be our partition. We're going to divide things equally. So for example, maybe cut up into four equal parts. Each part is, in this picture, exactly the same width. I mean, if you don't believe my drawing is exactly the same width for each part. But, okay. And these are all going to be less than delta, right? For example. Right? You might need to have a very large n, depending on how long b minus a is and how small delta is. And what happens in here? Now we think about, let me draw the graph of the function down here. What happens with the function? What we're promised is that if inputs are less than delta apart, outputs are less than epsilon apart. Okay. So here in terms of, okay. Here's our lower and upper sums, right? How far apart can things get? In any one of these pieces, if you look at any two particular points, so for example, if I look at two points in this interval, right? Whatever that distance is, the uniform continuity thing says that height is less than epsilon over b minus a. Okay? And now if you take the supremum over all points, it's going to be at most, it's possible that in the limit it becomes equal to epsilon over B minus A. Okay? But it can't get bigger. Okay? So all of the heights between these red bars are all going to be at most epsilon over B minus A. And then what we're really interested in is the area. Right? The area in these boxes would be the difference between the lower and upper Riemann sums. That would then be less than, well, each of these rectangles has height at most epsilon over B minus A, and then the total width then is exactly B minus A. Okay. So that's the argument in somewhat pictorial form. But that's how people actually understand the argument, is in terms of a picture. Then they can make it a little more formal if you want. Once you have the right picture, then it's just some language. Let's see here. Okay? So like more formally, you know, you could write something like this. About the supremum of all of the outputs on the kth interval. Minus the infimum of all of the outputs on the same interval. This is it's the least upper bound of this minus the greatest lower bound of that, and I claim this is, as I wrote there, less than or equal to epsilon over B minus A. If you want to try and prove it, you end up having to think carefully about the supremums and infimums there. So you have to use kind of the epsilonic characterization, but I already used epsilon, so I need another letter. So given gamma greater than zero, we can find some number X that approximates the supremum gamma well, or even gamma over 2 well, and then find another number Y that will approximate the infimum gamma over 2 well. Obvious typos. Endpoints backwards there. This is how I could state more formally what I drew. We can find X and Y in the interval. So what do I mean by approximate, you know, this thing gamma well? I just mean so this is the least upper bound of these kinds of numbers. Numbers from this interval plugged into F. So that means if you subtract any positive number from it, like gamma, that's not an upper bound. Because this is already the least upper bound. So you have this minus gamma. Now, we can actually approximate it gamma over 2 well, right? Subtract any positive number, including gamma over 2. Right, and this is no longer an upper bound for this set. So I can find an x that shows it's not an upper bound. Okay. And likewise, this is the greatest lower bound for this output set here. Okay. So I can find a y that shows that if I add gamma over 2 to this, it is not a lower bound anymore. Just adding that gamma over 2, since gamma over 2 is positive, will make this number greater than the greatest lower bound of this output set. So if this is not a lower bound, I can find something in the output set that's less than it. But then the x and the y being that interval, are less than delta apart, right? Because they're at most, since they're in this interval, the furthest apart they could be is if they were at opposite ends of the interval. Okay. So they're less than delta apart, so f of x minus f of y is less than epsilon over b minus a. That was how we chose the delta. So if you want to be really picky, you would say something along the lines next of really, it's important not only that the f of x be greater than this, but we also note that this in turn, I guess I can just write the next line. This f of x, all right, this is an upper bound for that f of x and all other inputs you can plug in here to get outputs. So you can have another side to this inequality here. And likewise, there's another side to this inequality in that the infimum here is a lower bound for all these f outputs. Okay. I think we need to shut that door. So if you see here, where'd it go? Yeah. Right, so this f of x rounded up to the supreme, so to speak, can carry along the negative gamma 2 here. So this, you know, you can fit there. And likewise, you can fit, this is just copied here, but this infima is a lower bound for, it's less than or equal to f of y, so you also get this. So actually, this infimum lives between f of y and f of y plus gamma over 2, and the supremum lives between f of x and f of x minus gamma over 2. So the distance between f of x and this supremum is less than gamma over 2. And here the distance is also between this infimum and f of y is less than gamma over 2. So you can put that all together and say that the distance between the supremum and the infimum is less than or equal to the distance
from, say, the supremum to f of x plus the distance from f of x to f of y plus the distance from f of y to the infimum. And this is less than epsilon over b minus a. This one is less than gamma over 2. So you get gamma plus the target upper bound. But this argument is valid for any positive gamma. The only way it can be true for all gammas at once is if actually the supreme and the infimum are most epsilon over b minus a apart. Okay. So that's this part right here. And then, of course, the because, you know, actually doing it formally kind of directly using the definitions of supremum and infimum takes a little bit of care. Intuitively, this is how I see it. The heights are always strictly less than epsilon over b minus a, so in the limit, the height difference is at most epsilon over b minus a. So, okay. So finally, we put all this together, and this quantity, we know this thing is going to be, certainly it can't be negative, but the other interesting point is that, you know, it can't be too big. So this is less than or equal to, let's just write it in terms of equal, right? I mean, how are these sums defined? You take the areas of the rectangles. So I'm just going to, you'll have the common widths. So some say k equals 1 to n. And now you're taking, when you take this subtraction here, you'll end up subtracting the heights for each term. And it just is in the picture. So you'll have that supremum. Same supremum as we had up there. Minus that infimum. You'll have the difference in height for each rectangle times the width for that rectangle. And then you round up all of these to their common upper bound, epsilon over b minus a. And then you have the sum of all the individual subinterval widths, which of course add up to b minus a. So we're done, because for any epsilon, we can get the lower and upper sums less than epsilon apart. So in the limit of finer and finer partitions, we can make the lower and upper sums as close together as we want, so there's a well-defined integral. So continuous functions are indeed Riemann integrable, as they say. And you have to use several ideas from stuff we've done earlier. We really needed uniform continuity, for example. And compactness came in to imply that it was even bounded in the first place. But once we had the uniform continuity, then it was kind of just, for me at least, just follow my nose. You know, okay, I have an epsilon that's kind of my goal, right, of getting these close together. So I just need to get the delta. All right, and then how do I implement that? Well, cut it up in a simple way. And so let me now. Of course, this is this very abstract process. What it does guarantee you that continuous functions have integrals, doesn't give you a clue about how to compute them except by literally approximating by rectangles. It doesn't give you a hint as to, you know, what makes calculus so great, which is the two fundamental theorems of calculus. Okay. And that's what we'll come to on Monday. Two fundamental theorems are, first fundamental theorem is essentially every continuous function has an antiderivative computed in terms of the Riemann integral by varying the endpoint. And
and what's the other point?
The second fundamental theorem also says then that to actually evaluate integrals, if you have an antiderivative, you do the usual thing of evaluating the antiderivative, the endpoints, and subtracting. So next time we'll talk about the fundamental theorems of calculus. And I will email you your homework assignment. Are there any questions about things? Whatever homework assignment you get tonight, with this integral stuff, draw pictures, think about areas of rectangles. It should give you a rough idea of how to solve it.